Now, I will start this a little differently than the usual sermon. I listened to a lot of sermons, and they followed essentially the same structure. They chose one particular gospel. They wrote, they read the parable of the sower from the one gospel, and then they used that as the main structure, and then perhaps gained some additional details from other gospels. Now, I will structure this a little differently. I will read every version, all three versions of the parable from all the gospels where they occur, namely Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So this will take a little more time than usual, but it's informative to pay attention to the small details, small differences, different emphasis, different words chosen between all the gospel authors. Because let's remember, Jesus almost certainly preached this in Aramaic. So now, since every gospel author is writing in Koine Greek, they will have to choose some, they will have to make some of their own choices in how exactly they will communicate this in a different language. And they will have to consider their audience too. Like, is their expected audience very well versed in the Old Testament? Have they been reading the Septuagint, and they will recognize certain words immediately as references to Septuagint? Or does the author need to explain things to someone who is maybe only vaguely familiar with the Old Testament, like would be the case with Luke, who was writing just the Theophilus? So Luke will understandably be interpreting a lot more. So let's start with Matthew, a very decidedly Jewish author. That same day, Jesus went out of the house and sat beside the sea, and great crowds gathered about him, so that he got into a boat and sat down. And the whole crowd.
The boat. You didn't mention the boat.
Yeah. Matthew chapter 13, starting from verse 1 and continuing. And he told them many things in parables, saying, a sower went out to sow. And as he sowed, some seeds fell along the path, and the birds came and devoured them. Other seeds fell on rocky ground, where they did not have much soil, and immediately they sprang up, since they had no depth of soil. But when the sun rose, they were scorched, and since they had no root, they withered away. Other seeds fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked them. Other seeds fell on good soil and produced grain, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. He who has ears, let him hear. Then the disciples came and said to him, why do you speak to them in parables? And he answered them, to you it has been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given. For to the one who has, more will be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. This is why I speak to them in parables, because seeing they do not see, and hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand. Indeed, in their case, the prophecy of Isaiah is fulfilled, that says, you will indeed hear but never understand, and you will indeed see but never perceive. For this people's heart has grown dull, and with their ears they can barely hear, and their eyes they have closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart and turn, and I would heal them. But blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For truly I say to you, many prophets and righteous people longed to see what you see, and did not see it, and to hear what you hear, and did not hear it. Hear then the parable of the sower. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, the evil one comes and snatches away what has been sown in his heart. This is what was sown along the path. As for what was sown on rocky ground, this is the one who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. Yet he has no root in himself, but endures for a while. And when tribulation or persecution arises on account of the word, immediately he falls away. As for what was sown among thorns, this is the one who hears the word, but the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and it proves unfruitful. As for what was sown in good soil, this is the one who hears the word and understands. He indeed bears fruit and yields, in one case 100-fold, in another 60, and in another 30. And that concludes the parable in Matthew. Following to Mark, this is chapter 4, verse 2. So Mark 4, verse 2. And he was teaching them many things in parables. And in his teaching he said to them, "Listen, a sower went out to sow. And as he sowed, some seed fell along the path, and the birds came and devoured it. Other seed fell on rocky ground, where it did not have much soil, and immediately it sprang up, since it had no depth of soil. And when the sun rose, it was scorched, since it had no root. It withered away. Other seed fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked it, and it yielded no grain. And other seeds fell into good soil and produced grain, growing up and increasing and yielding 30-fold and 60-fold and 100-fold. And he said, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." And when he was alone, those around him with the 12 asked him about the parables. And he said to them, "To you has been given the secret of the kingdom of God, but for those outside everything is in parables, so that they may indeed see but not perceive, and may indeed hear but not understand, lest they should turn and be forgiven." And he said to them, "Do you not understand this parable? How then will you understand all the parables? The sower sows the word. And these are the ones along the path where the word is sown. When they hear, Satan immediately comes and takes away the word that is sown in them. And these are the ones sown on rocky ground, the ones who, when they hear the word, immediately receive it with joy. And they have no root in themselves, but endure for a while. Then when tribulation or persecution arises on account of the word, immediately they fall away. And others are the ones sown among thorns. They are those who hear the word, but the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches and the desires for other things enter in and choke the word, and it proves unfruitful. But those that were sown on the good soil are the ones who hear the word and accept it and bear fruit 30-fold and 60-fold and 100-fold. And that concludes the parable in Mark. Finally, Luke. So this is Luke chapter 8, and starting from verse 5. Luke 8, starting from verse 5. A sower went out to sow his seed, and as he sowed, some fell along the path, and was trampled underfoot, and the birds of the air devoured it. And some fell on the rock, and as it grew up, it withered away, because it had no moisture. And some fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up with it and choked it. And some fell into good soil and grew and yielded 100-fold. As he said these things, he called out, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." And when the disciples asked him what this parable meant, he said, "To you it has been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of God, but for others they are in parables, so that seeing they may not see, and hearing they may not understand." Now the parable is this: the seed is the word of God. The ones along the path are those who have heard. Then the devil comes and takes away the word from their hearts, so that they may not believe and be saved. And the ones on the rock are those who, when they hear the word, receive it with joy. But these have no root. They believe for a while, and in time of testing fall away. And as for what fell among the thorns, they are those who hear, but as they go on their way, they are choked by the cares and riches and pleasures of life, and their fruit does not mature. As for that in the good soil, they are those who, hearing the word, hold it fast in an honest and good heart, and bear fruit with patience. And that finally concludes the Luke edition of the parable. So immediately, you probably noticed one difference. Luke does not mention all the numbers. Luke only says 100-fold. Now, one might be inclined at this point to conclude that Luke is the least informative of these, so that we would go to different parables for those details. But there is actually a detail that is, if you dig into the Greek, there's a detail only mentioned by Luke. Now, you might guess this, but this is in fact confirmed by reading only the Luke version of the story. Because he uses a different word than all the rest for the 100. So Matthew and Mark use hekatonta. So that would either mean literally 100 or it would mean 100-fold. It's used in both ways, but you wouldn't be sure. And so is with every single other number there. All of the numbers are simply the number 30, the number 60, and the number 100. The fold there, which tells you of a multiple or increase, is not there in Matthew and Mark. But here, when Luke mentions just this one number, he actually uses a different word. So that is hekatonta plasion, so compound word. And this now confirms that we are talking about a multiplication. We are talking about increase. And this is why even the most literal Bible translations, even Young's literal translation, which is absolutely ridiculously literal, inserts the fold into all the rest of the Gospels. Now, why is he so confident in this? Because Luke confirms it. And this is kind of a pattern that you see when you just dig into every single version of this parable. Because there is clearly some reason why the Holy Spirit chose to include this in a particular number. You usually do not find the same narrative in three Gospels. You typically find it in two, and so slight differences. But this here, all of them pay a lot of attention. And you will find by comparing them side by side, especially in a good literal translation, or preferably in Greek, you will find details that you would not have found otherwise. And again, let's remember, the original speech was probably in Aramaic, so none of these ambiguities would be there. It's up to the gospel writer and his audience to choose how to interpret it and what to emphasize. So here we see a different emphasis in Luke, but he then omits all the numbers, because those numbers are important too. A different false idea is avoided by then considering all those numbers. I will get to that later. Then, on a second count, Luke is actually the more ambiguous choice of words. Because when we consider this stony ground, now we might actually be imagining, we might have three different pictures in our mind of what stony ground is. So, number one, it's just littered with perfectly apparent stones on the surface. That's probably the first image that you would get from the words rocky ground. Second possibility, we're talking about bedrock that is above ground, because it says it has no depth of soil. Now, moss does grow on bedrock, so there is some potential for growth over a bedrock. And third possibility, it's actually not evident bedrock. It's underneath the soil. So there's a little bit of soil. It looks perfectly fine, but there's a bedrock which would be limestone in this particular region. So now Luke is very short in this. He just says Petra. However, Matthew is more informative with this choice of words. Now it's the opposite word. Previously, Luke chose the compound word that was more informative. Now, Matthew is the one that uses the compound word that is more informative. So when Luke says Petra, Matthew says Petrades, which is a compound word from Petra and Eidos. Now, the Eidos means form, and Petra obviously means rock. And it doesn't mean any old stone that you could pull away. Rock is obviously solid rock. Anyone who has discussed with Catholics about Peter's name and Petr, know that Petr refers to a bigger rock, not one that you carry away easily. So here we have a rock form. We might coin a word and say that this soil is petriform, because that's kind of the gist of the used compound word. So now this eliminates the idea of these being just rocks that you could have carried away but didn't on the soil. And they wouldn't have done that anyway. That's the very first thing that the farmers in this age and in this region would do. They would first remove all the evident rocks, then they would till the ground, and then they would sow. So, when we get this more specific word from Matthew, we have to conclude that we are some way talking about solid rock somewhere. Now, we need further detail to differentiate between the above ground rock and below ground rock. I'll get to that later, but again we see that from the choice of words we have eliminated one possibility. And I will show that ultimately only one reading becomes possible. Ultimately we will reach a picture of everything that's happening that just, it rules out all the wrong ideas that we would get on first reading, especially reading this in a translation of the Greek. And finally we will see what is actually going on in the picture. Then there is the part about the thorns. Again, this is easily pictured in two possible ways. Are the thorns obviously and evidently there when he's throwing the seed? Now, some of these word choices might lead you in that direction. Like, and you would wonder why is the sower throwing the seed there in the first place? Like, this is obviously a hopeless place. If it's just an area just completely riddled with thorns and weeds, why is the seed going there at all? But here we again have different choices of words when the gospel authors dig down into what is going on with those weeds. So Matthew, about what happens with the weeds, how they rise up and choke the seed. Matthew is a little bit more poetic. He just says that they rise up. He uses the Greek word anabaino. But Luke uses a much more technical word that says that the thorns grow up with it. In other words, the seed and the thorns start from the same stage, which then needs to be a seed. Like, both of them get their chance at the same time, and the weeds win. Now, everybody who has lived in this fallen world knows that this is exactly what happens. The weeds always win if they are in the same place with actual edible grain. So again, comparing the Gospels, we gain more information. Now we know that the thorns weren't actually evident. The ground wasn't littered with them, and the sower behaved perfectly sensibly. So now, let's combine the worst possible way to imagine this. Like, when you're hearing these words, and this is pretty much how I originally pictured the words in my mind when I first read just the translation of the picture. And the behavior of the sower makes absolutely zero sense at all if you read it that way. So first of all, unfortunately, when it's describing what is the wayside, or many different words are used, some translations like NASB say road. Now that conjures up the idea of a paved road. Like the main road that would cross the cities of the country. Now, why would the sower be walking there in the first place? This picture of a paved road and the seed ending up there conjures up the picture that the sower actually comes out of the field and goes out of his way to sow the seed in the least sensible place imaginable. So that's the problem with the first ground. You may imagine the road is that, but what it actually is an organic path that goes between the strips of land that contain the soil. Because that is actually how we find from historical information that they did it. They were thin strips, just thin enough so that both the sower could sow the seed from the path at the side, and then the reaper would be able to reap ultimately their crop never stepping on the tilled soil. They would remain on the paths. And the word here refers to that path that has formed simply by walking on it. So at this point, the sower's behavior makes perfect sense. He's casting the seed, and since the strip is very narrow, it is just bound some of the seed to fall on the path. Now also, because this is a very dry region, we know that the surface of the path is exceedingly dry. So if we're thinking in our country, we might still imagine that the seed has a little bit of hope there. But actually, when we consider how the earth, like, it would be like solid clay, the seed has absolutely zero hope there, but there is a reason why it ends up there. The sower is not behaving in any kind of odd way here. This is just how it's done. Because what they prioritized at the time was that the seed would be spread evenly. And that was the first consideration of all, because they didn't want to crowd any particular patch of land with seed. They would just be competing with each other. The first consideration was to throw the seed in a wide arc. They had a bag of seeds and they were just casting it. They call it broadcasting the seed. I'm sure it may be a little bit wrong idea to us about media and such, but that is a style of casting seed. Like, you prioritize the even spread and you consider the seeds that fall on the trodden path as sort of cost of doing business. Something that is just bound to happen when you prioritize making the seed even. So, again, the sower is bathing sensibly as far as the path goes. Now, then the shallow, I already kind of talked about this, the rocky ground with its shallow, with its lack of moisture. Like, again, if again you imagine those rocks on the surface, then two people have actually made an error. First of all, the one who prepared the ground would never have left rocks there. That would be the first thing you do. And second of all, if the sower did see completely unprepared ground, he would never have thrown the seed there. But when we have figured out, and how do we pin it down to this only one possibility, that the bedrock is not evident to the sower? Well, now that we have these two options, above ground rock and below ground rock, now we pay attention that the seed actually sprouts impressively fast. We get the idea from the text that it's actually faster than on the good ground. And this is what would happen in that way. Because here's the problem for the farmer. The till just did not go very deep. It was a kind of technological limitation. So they would not know whether there is bedrock under it. They would maybe 10, 15 centimeters. They would know about it, but then they would have no idea what's going beneath it. And from historical sources that several preachers mentioned, we find that in these circumstances, the grain actually does sprout impressively fast, faster than the rest. Because once the root reaches the limit of where it can go, then the plant will put every resource that it has on the above ground growth. So the farmer would already be concerned when he sees a plot of land that looks better at the initial stages than the rest. And then when ultimately the inevitable happens, the dry season starts to come and it just dies there, then he knows, okay, this is the problem with the land, I'm not going to sow a seed anywhere in that region ever again. But you would know that at the first time. This land also looked the same to the sower. So again, the sower is behaving sensibly. And then, as I mentioned, the thorns. The only thing here that makes sense of all the words, the highly technical word used, is that it was not obvious grown-up thorns. It was seeds. It was a weed problem in the milled, in the tilled ground. So again, the ground would look the same with the sower at the point of sowing the seed. The problem only would come after a while, after he witnesses what happens to the ground. Now, in comes the weed, but simultaneously come all those weeds. And at this point, you know that you have a problem here, but not at the time of sowing. So So at every point, if you have the wrong picture, you have the sower of the seed behaving in a completely nonsensical way every step of the way. But you have to understand that every piece of land looks the same, except obviously the path. Only the path is evident to the sower. Nothing else at the point of sowing is evident. And this obviously has an application to how we do in evangelism, because this is in fact what we do see. We see the obvious resistance that we can immediately tell that anything that we say had absolutely zero effect. But then we have problems that are only evident later, and they may never be evident to us. They will be evident to someone else, namely the farmer who expects to actually make the harvest. So it will not be the evangelist's problem, it will be the pastor's problem, and occasion for church discipline later. But anyway, so now that we have the picture together, now let's consider the original audience and the fact that they would have known this, because this parable was preached in an agricultural region. They would have actually been doing this. For us, we need to get this from tiny hints in the text, just the right word chosen by just the right gospel author, and some recorded statements in church history, because when Christendom spread to Europe, we had very little idea of how farming was done in that region, but we occasionally had travelers from that region, and we were able in the first centuries to ask some questions, and they made some clarifying remarks of what is actually going on here, and we kind of put the picture together in church history. So we have two approaches, we have two sources of information. We have the hints that are not evident in the text, and then we also have from church history like recorded statements of what is going on and what is not going on in this picture. But let's again remember that every single person in that region, this would be familiar to them. They would have been doing this for decades. Like, all the way to the good ground, everything that Jesus said would have been, they would have been waiting for Jesus to get to the point, because they know all this. Like, we have to do some detective work all the way up here, but they would have been just waiting for Jesus to get to the point, which he in fact does. But not quite where we might think, if we find all these strange ways that the sower seems to be behaving here. Also a remark about the path. Now, some of the Gospels emphasize the role of Satan more than others. Some people put the birds in much more focus, and some focus on the path. So, should we see this as the innocent person perfectly willing to receive the gospel, but then Satan is the problem here? Like, if Satan just hadn't come and removed the word from that person could have been saved. Well, not really. Because, again, the ground is hard. It's trodden hard, like hardened clay. So I think the birds are there to make sure just how hopeless this is. Because even with hardened clay, there would be some cracks. Like, a few lucky seeds might find a crack somewhere and actually manage to spring up. But the birds are there so that we don't think that maybe with these people there is a 0.01 probability of salvation, but we might try anyway. Well, no, the birds are going to handle the rest. This is, in my opinion, this is to emphasize just that there is absolutely zero chance that this kind of ground will receive the word. Otherwise, all the Gospels would emphasize on the Satan if this was mainly about him. But this is about the nature of the soils. The Satan is an additional detail. And then finally, like, we think we are safe when we come to the good ground. Like, there is no way to misunderstand this one. But yes, there actually is. And it's with regards to the numbers. Also, this misunderstanding I did find in a few materials. Not many, but some draw this conclusion without actually looking deeply into the historical information and the hints in the text. So here, okay, we understand what good ground is like, but then when it mentions all those 30-fold, 60-fold, and 100-fold growth, and remember, it's in most of those Gospels, it's just the number. Now we have two possibilities again. We might imagine that the individual stalk is either growing 30 seeds in it, 60 seeds in it, or 100 seeds in it. Or the other way to understand these words is that the strip of land that represents the good land brings a 30-fold, 60-fold, or 100-fold increase return of investment for the sower. So this is the other way to understand it. Obviously the bag of seeds is going to cost something. So how much profit is the farmer going to gain from this strip of land after investing in the bag of seeds? Now it turns out that biologically these numbers make no sense at all if we're thinking about the individual stalk. First of all, the same kind of seed is going to produce roughly the same number of seeds in the stalk, and anyway these numbers don't make sense even with that in mind. But they do make sense with the profit in mind, and they actually bring up the profit approach shows what the important point here is, why they were waiting for Jesus to finally get the point here. And if we have the picture of Jesus' emphasis being completely on the individual stalk, then again that is fertile ground, no pun intended, for us to take a pharisaical approach to this. We're thinking about ourselves. How many good works have we performed? Like, have we performed the number of 30 good works, and should we now be getting to the number of 60? But it's not about the individual stalk, it's about the plot of land and the nature of the plot of land. So the numbers with regards, and the biology with regards to the profit, make sense, but they draw out now the final point, why this is the line where we kind of draw this parable as the large crowd heard it. Because remember, they did not hear the explanation. These are the only words they heard. So the way we have to listen to this is what would they have thought, naturally knowing from personal experience all the things that I laid out here. And here's with these numbers is where they would have reacted the first. Because several preachers, R.C. Sproul and John MacArthur notably, actually looked a little bit into this. R.C. Sproul found the answer in church history about what the expected profit would have been. From, again, this comes from church history, and the expected exceptional profit that would have made the farmer exceedingly happy was tenfold profit. John MacArthur took a little different approach, and he actually got in the statistic. And it was the average good year would bring something about sevenfold profit. I think the number was exactly 7.25. But both are clearly in the same ballpark. So somewhere between 7 and 10 is what we would expect that would make the farmer exceedingly happy. But now here we start at 30. And we go to 100, which, with that in mind, would be a completely preposterous number. The 30 would already be a clear miracle, like something supernatural is going on here, and then Jesus just goes, hit it way out of the park with this 100 number. So now they would have the first hint to understand that this here must be the key to understanding what they had heard. We have the advantage of having Jesus explain all these details. But here's, again, an interesting thing with regard to the large crowd that never got to hear the details. Because right after laying out these numbers, Jesus says, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." Now this is not just a throwaway phrase, and again, here we find something interesting comparing the Gospels. Because not all of them, in fact, report those words in these exact words. Now, Textus Receptus does, but it seems that someone tried to kind of make all the text the same. But Matthew is the one that just says, "He who has an ear, let him hear." He doesn't say, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. So if we just, and this is obviously in Neste Åland, the manuscript that is considered the most reliable these days. Again, it seems that someone tried to fix the problem in Dextrus Receptus, which was based on not very many manuscripts, but we find that Matthew is a little shorter here, but the rest include this. So the here, there is twice. Ears to hear, let him hear. Now, let's remember that at the time they would be extremely familiar with the Old Testament. They would probably gather right away what the reference is. Because Deuteronomy chapter 29, verse 4. So, Deuteronomy 29, verse 4 says, "But to this day the Lord has not given you a heart to understand, or eyes to see, or ears to hear." They would recognize. Now, I checked in the Greek, like, what would the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, say, and compared it to how it's reported in the Gospel. And it's the exact same word. So the author was clearly emphasizing that the audience would have recognized the reference. So there is hearing, and then there is having ears to hear. Two kind of hearing. Like, these are not biologically deaf people. One of them hears the words, but doesn't really, they don't penetrate the heart. He may understand them intellectually, but that's everything that happens. And then there's another type of person who truly understands what is being said. And just with this information, without the explanation, Jesus has already said, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." So there must be something to pick up on just based on this alone. Now, there is, of course, the other agenda, and that is reported by every one of the gospel authors. The fact that he doesn't explain it is a judgment. And it is clearly a judgment to those who do not have, who have ears, but not to hear, as Deuteronomy says. But since we interestingly find that just these words, already Jesus says that we should be able to pick something up, even without the explanation, if just we have ears to hear, then we should be paying attention to that. We should be trying to hear and trying to picture the whole scene like the original audience would have pictured. Because then when we draw the application to our personal evangelism and how we view the people who react in all these ways, if we have the wrong picture in mind, we might be drawn to all sorts of errors in this. I will get that in the last point, like what... How should this drive our way of evangelism? But again, I want to draw attention to that. There comes this one point, and then immediately Jesus makes the statement. So the numbers and the fact that it is miraculous is clearly important. Now, one detail of those Gospels that I read, it is interesting that only one draws attention to that detail, and that is Mark. So let's go back to Mark chapter 4, verse 13. The rest reported pretty much the same way, but Mark makes a remark that is kind of, well, let me just read it again. Chapter 4, verse 13. "And he said to them, 'Do you not understand this parable? How then will you understand all the parables?'" And then he goes to explain. None of the others say this. They mention the judgment. They mention why he didn't explain it. But there is also this apparent rebuke of the disciples. They already have clearly done something wrong. Jesus expected something better of them. So what can it be? Well, is it reasonable to expect the disciples to get every single detail of the parable on first hearing? I don't think that would be reasonable, but they would have been. It would have been reasonable for them to at least pay attention to the part that Jesus explicitly paid attention, namely the numbers. So the right question I think that they should have asked at this point is, okay, a miracle is happening here and we see some connection with perhaps the miracle about Joseph and Egypt and feeding the Israelites. So the right question, I think, would have been, how then do we get this miracle? But it seems that the disciples were just, we don't understand, explain everything, Jesus. So I think that kind of that in my mind explains all the details here. Why Jesus sounded disappointed and why he gave the exhortation to some people to hear these words, even though he didn't explain it. So, just to repeat what I said earlier, because I think it's important, with this fact of every single number being clearly miraculous, we should just forget about the interpretation of the good soils and seeing that there is this difference in the soils, 30, 60 and 100. We should not try to count our own words and think about how to get to a better category. Now the ground is what it is. Every single ground is what it is. None of them can choose to be a different kind of ground than it is. It is in the nature of the ground. And everyone who is saved is already a miracle. So this cannot be about attempting in the flesh to raise the tally of your good works. This just needs to be the observation that some people are perhaps more obviously and more visibly used by God, but every person who is saved is a miracle. So the one that is the 30 kind of ground should not feel inferior to the 100 kind of ground. This is just the way that God has designed the system. None of these grounds is able to decide to be some other ground than it actually is. The only person who is even able to make any kind of a choice in this picture is the sower. None of the grounds can make a choice, but the sower does. The sower does have some options. Now, obviously, since we have gathered this picture, like, the result is miraculous success. So a question we might ask is the sower here doing things right? Well, clearly he is doing things right from the miraculous result. Again, if we just thought about the stalk and thought of these as ordinary numbers and exhortation to perform more good works, then we might wonder about the sower. Is he behaving sensibly? But yes, this clearly is the template that Jesus has presented on how to do evangelism. This, on the part of the sower, we have the only place for any kind of choice. Now, what are the two choices that we might theoretically have on how to do evangelism when considering this picture? Well, the one would be, how exactly do we put the seed in the ground? Now, the example is broadcasting the seed. So if in our style of evangelism we do not even ever encounter the hardened response, then we are clearly trying to be more clever as the sower than Jesus' example. We might be, this accusation has been leveled to us reformed people, that we just kind of go fishing only in charismatic churches and try to get members from there and completely ignore the basic evangelism. And that might even be true for some churches, but that would be a violation of the principle that Jesus lays out here. The sower is not particularly careful in where he pushes down the seed, like we might be these days. We would probably push the seed, every single seed individually, down with our finger, but that is not how the sower is doing it. So we must be seeing some resistance, or if we're not seeing any, then we're doing something wrong. So we must be broadcasting our message. But we shouldn't do it in the foolish way of picturing these things either, where we go, like, if we imagine the paved road where there's no hope, we might think that it is our duty to go to the most hopeless people imaginable. Like, we might think that this is telling us to go into some atheist meeting specifically just in order to put a check in the box that now we handle the road and now we try to find some emotionally shallow people and then we check another box. No, the sower is, it's simply about the fact how he's spreading the gospel. He's spreading in a way that it will encounter every single category of person. So that should be our example. Now, sometimes we might still go to some of those problematic churches, but that is not really the evangelism. When we say evangelism, we should be talking about broadcasting the message. Evangelism should be general. Every type of ground should be encountered. So there is a choice being made by the sower about how he throws the seed. Then the second possible choice is what kind of seed is he throwing. So again, here we have some infamous examples of throwing the wrong kind of seed, because this seed is identified as the actual word of God. Now let's imagine what prosperity gospel would look like in terms of this parable. Now the sower might be throwing dandelion seeds everywhere, or any weed, and he would, it would look like he's getting a much better result, because at least in all the three grounds, the seed would grow absolutely magnificently. It's just that it produces the bad results and makes the problem worse on every single ground, but it might look really good. So we're clearly doing something wrong if we are not seeing this result. We need to be sowing the kind of word of God where we see some fall away for the various reasons. Either the emotional shallowness of the initial reaction, or else the fact that the worries of life and riches and those, they choke the seed and it becomes unfruitful. So important lessons that first of all the message needs to be right, and we can tell it that it's right from seeing all these responses, and it needs to be, the spread of the gospel needs to be the emphasis, like it is for the farmer in this case. Now finally, to the point where I intended to start this sermon. Like, now let's look at what's going on with the Reformed lens. How do we imagine, with all the Calvinist doctrines in mind, what's going on here? Well, again, I point out that none of these grounds is in this picture able to choose to be any other ground than it actually is. The only difference that is going on in this picture with regards to the seed, the only change that is happening is that the ground reveals what kind of a ground it is. But in this picture, it was always that kind of ground. It was that kind of ground before the seed and after the seed. And only one of the categories of response was obvious at the time of throwing. So here we come to the perseverance of the saints, because we Calvinists believe that how you tell someone's election is the fact that they persevere to the end. And this is exactly in this picture how they can see what kind of ground it is. The sower simply cannot know. One ground resists immediately. One ground starts out really impressively, maybe even more impressively than your average actual elect, but very quickly you see them just completely fade away. No life at all. In the metaphor, the sun burns the stalk, that is the shallow ground. And then the even less evident one is the one choked out by the thorns. That might actually take decades, because obviously life has to have the opportunity to present this problem. Maybe someone didn't find that kind of material success, or the particular temptation that the word has to offer, that is the temptation that they are especially susceptible to. So all of these problems take a lot of time for us to be able to rule out all the bad grounds and pin this particular person down to the good soil. So we need to see the saint persevere until we are in any position to say anything about the matter. But we don't have to say anything about the matter, because our command is to broadcast the seed. We, as the evangelists, simply do not have to consider. We just expect to find them all, and then ultimately, even with all these problems, the result is still miraculous. So that should be the encouragement to be doing this thing. Like every problem that you encounter, none of them should discourage you in any way, because taking away all those problems, removing all those people from ultimately the number of the elect as you determine them from the perseverance of the saints, the end result, the final tally, is still a miracle, even in the least profitable servant. So there is just really nothing to think about. The evangelism is not a hard intellectual problem. It's mostly a problem of courage. Like finding the courage to do it the right way, so the right message and in the right way, knowing that you will encounter these problems. Just daring to do that is the only problem here. This does not require learning, and this does not require any particular intellect. So those would be my observations of all the sermons, of the maybe 10 sermons that I read or watched on this matter, and most of these were things that were identified on average by one, maybe two speakers. So these are other things that I gathered, that whenever you listen to a generic sermon on the matter, then just add these little pieces of information to that, and that will present you the full picture. Because there's a lot that I did not mention that every sermon on the topic will inform you. They will present very useful personal anecdotes. For example, Spurgeon, who did this for a very long time and very successfully, he had personal anecdotes of all the types of stories and all the types of responses here. And then there's the application to our sanctification about all the problems. Because these, all the problems that are within these soils, even though none of these people can choose to be elect, these are still temptations that the world presents. So in fighting those temptations, which is the part in sanctification, we have a lot to learn about all these problems and how to beat them. We just never should put this information into the wrong box. If we put it into the box of choosing to be saved, then we are immediately off to the wrong track in interpreting the whole thing. As far as sanctification goes, these are useful things, and you will gain that information from essentially any sermon preached on a topic. So that is once again my encouragement. Do listen to at least one general sermon on this in addition to mine, and preferably John MacArthur's, if you're only going to listen to one. So that would now conclude my teaching. I hope it will be helpful in addition to someone who will do the general teaching much better than I ever could. Because I had the competition that I would have here, anyone who is anybody in Reformed circles has done sermons on this, and some of them twice from different Gospels. So that's kind of how it became evident to me that there is no point for me as a second time teacher to do the same thing that the absolute masters in this topic throughout all history of Protestantism has done vastly better than me. So I just decided to gather the bits and pieces identified only by single people. So it's intended to be a supplemental teaching for a primary teaching on the topic. So let me end in prayer. Father in heaven, I ask now that you would allow these words and all these details, none of which I figured out on my own, none of these are the result of my own cleverness. These are possibly the result of an entire life of faithful preaching and teaching and digging into the historical details, sometimes doing original work. The only thing that I have done here is to identify them and gather the things that people would miss if they don't listen to as many sermons as I did. So in the spirit I ask that you would cause these words to be helpful, so that when someone then listens to someone like John MacArthur on the topic, they will have the right picture in their mind, how the actual sowing here happens, what are the grounds like, so that the interpretation would then not receive the wrong focus or wrong perspective and wrong ideas. So help all of this affect our hearts, and if we have any hardening of our own in our work of sanctification, similar to the hardened ground, then let all this information, all this teaching penetrate our hardened heart, and let us return to the good soil that we were always intended to be. Give us all these gifts as Christendom, all these 30-fold, 60-fold, and 100-fold people, and let them not be stressed about which exact soil they are, because the type is always, in all cases, determined by you. Let us simply focus on the task that you have actually given us, which is spreading the gospel and growing in sanctification, which are not competing things, because we will then spread the gospel better. But both of these things will feed on each other. So let us keep the focus in what you intended the focus to be, and not start counting our works and feeding our flesh and stressing out on the particular number of good works that we have performed. Help all this bring perspective and bring us peace, and concentrate on your grace that you promised right from the start, when there were no apostles yet. Only Jesus himself at this time was the actual sower here. Now, we too are the sowers. The apostles were the first sowers, and now we have inherited this task. Let us concentrate on how to do that work right, and all of these things that might cause us to develop a pharisaical spirit, let us, all those disappear, and let us concentrate on learning how to evangelize and learning how to grow in sanctification. These things I ask in the name of your Son, Christ Jesus. Amen.